Alright. So, you two and I can meet after the meeting briefly, okay? She needs some help with forms and stuff. Oh,
yeah.
Oh, okay, great. Well, that was a close call, right?
Jeez.
You're valuable. Yeah, I need a pen.
I know. I was like, oh, man.
The message was ambiguous, but why did I interpret it one way or the other? If it was like ambiguous, why did I?
Yeah,
it was
a
All right, so. Okay, good. We got everybody now. So, I mentioned last week to all of you that we're going to be starting coding team, and we have our team here. Fortunately, Deb was able to come on board. She drives a hard bargain, but we were able to snag her, even though she's not formally doing a research assistantship with us. She's doing a fellowship, but not a research assistantship, but I was able to entice her to come and join us. So we have our team of six. So we'll figure out who gets paired with whom as we go along, but I'm just really excited about this team, and I know that Deb J, not Deb C, but Deb J, will be able to carry on this team and get highly reliable data after I go on sabbatical. So I'm very confident in your abilities. Deb Jabko is a third-year student, and she received some very specialized training this past summer from a man named Howard Steele, who is a professor at the New School. And Howard Steele is one of four individuals who developed the reflective functioning coding system for the adult attachment interview. Howard Steele worked in conjunction with his wife, Miriam, who's also at the New School, and Peter Fonagy at University of London, and Mary Target, also at the University of London. And they both have appointments at the Anna Freud Center in London to develop this scale. And Deb, you're waiting to hear whether you're actually reliable. So she completed the training, which was several days, cost a lot of money. And at the end, then she had to code how many AAIs? 15 AAIs for reflective functioning, which she did, and she submitted them to Howard Steele, and then he has the master list, or the master key of the ratings on these same 15 that he did himself. And so all he does is he takes the 15 of his ratings, he takes the 15 ratings of hers and looks at them and compares them and sees whether she's reliable. So reliability is typically established at 0.8, so it means 80% of Howard's ratings have to match hers, or vice versa. And if she can do that, if she establishes that, then she's considered a certified coder of reflective functioning, which is a very highly sought after skill in the world of attachment research and what? In the world of Dr. Goodman. No, you could actually hang out a shingle and start working. All kinds of researchers all over the world are looking for reliable, certified RF coders, and hopefully you will be one of them after you complete this process. Now, if you fail, he gives you an additional how many AAIs?
I think if I don't match up, he tells me to look back at my notes on certain transcripts and change it around.
Oh, so he cheats.
So he cheats, yeah. Yeah, I guess that's a little bit.
It's a little bit cheating. We'll see how it goes, but I took the same training back in 2006, and I really enjoyed it, but I didn't even bother to go through the reliability process because it's so onerous. I mean, it takes a lot of work. So I applaud your perseverance in completing those 15 AAIs for coding. It's a lot. I don't know how many hours it took you, but I'm guessing probably at least 15 hours, right? Probably more. Yeah. So it's a lot of work. Now, fortunately for us, we're not coding the AAI. We're coding psychotherapy transcripts. So we're applying a coding instrument, coding system, that was originally designed for the adult attachment interview, and we're applying that to a different set of data, which are psychotherapy transcripts. And we're hoping that this will work. Now, it's only been attempted twice before in the literature, once in 2004 and once in 2006. Successfully, we hope to be the third lab to be able to do that, and I think that we have the personnel in place to be able to do it. We've got the leader, we've got an advisor. I think with all those people in place, I think we'll be able to pull it off. So that's an introduction to Deb, and I think we should go around the room because Deb does know everybody and introduce ourselves. I'm Jeff Goodman.
Nice to meet you.
And say what who you are, like what you're up to. You are the assistant project coordinator.
Yes, assistant project coordinator.
So she is a work study student. She's a sophomore at Post, and she's in the psychology department. And she'd like to go on to get graduate training in clinical psychology. She wants to go to Berkeley.
Yeah,
I believe. So those are some key features of Jessica. Now she's going to be working with Tina, the person next to her, in basically coordinating the psychotherapy transcripts, who gets what weeks, and that frees you up a little bit because you're going to be doing coding as well. So I wanted to free up your time a little bit. So these two folks are going to be helping with that.
Thank you.
So, that's Tina's next. Go ahead.
Tina, She's the
best of the best. She's worked with me for 3+ years. She's done project coordination on previous studies, has her name on posters, and so she's been posterized a couple of times, I think. So that's Tina.
Tina, fine.
She's a co-editor this year for the first time.
Michelle.
And Michelle's also interested in going to Uganda next year. And I don't know Kimmy very well because you waved out of my child psychopathology, so I can't add anything. So that's the crew.
Thank you, everybody.
It's so nice to have a coding team provided, and I really appreciate coming here and helping me out a lot.
So I'm responsive to students, right?
Very, very responsive.
So if you work with me in your dissertation, this is what you get. A lot of hand-holding.
You get emails right away back. You're not left confused, which is really helpful on such a big project. So I'm really happy to meet everybody and to start. I thought I would show you the poster from
So basically, how much did you talk about?
Very little.
Okay.
we have plenty of time. So Deb did a poster with Tristan in the third year class and me. And she presented it, well actually Tristan presented it, I guess, in Hawaii. And so she brought it along just to show, but this is the data that we're going to be coding, and this is for one of the five patients.
So there are five patients total for the dissertation, but yeah, I guess we'll just talk about the poster now. So we do, there were, for each patient, there were a different number of transcripts that were transcribed. So patient five is the patient that we focused on for this poster. Patient five had 20 transcripts on the DNA transcribed. So we had 20 transcripts to test whether this patient was able to, with 6 months treatment, 3 times a week, so every amount of treatment, to increase, whether or not this patient increased her capacity to mentalize, which, did we talk about mentalization?
Just a little bit.
So mentalization is the ability to understand your own mental beliefs, feelings, thoughts, as well as somebody else's. So an example would be a patient with, and so the way to measure mentalization is through the reflective functioning scale. So like a vignette of what low RF would look like would be if someone got into, if an older person got in a fight with her parents and her parents were telling this person that she has to be home at a certain time, she has to abide by these rules. This patient might say, my parents hate me, not indicating any sort of, maybe your parents want to go after her, maybe your parents have ulterior motives.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me if I'm.
Well, tell you.
A patient with high RF. Actually, high RF is pretty rare. Five is sort of the high mark within that. But so a patient with higher RF would understand her patients are looking at her, parents are looking after her. Her parents might be worried about the crowd she's hanging out with. She might be able to grasp what her parents are doing without her parents specifically saying, we are doing this because we are looking out for you. Does that make sense? So this page, so we hypothesized that throughout this 6 month treatment period, this patient's RF, her capacity to mentalize, would increase. We also, Dr. Goodman had all of the symptoms of this patient throughout the 6 months. That's through the symptom checklist.
Otherwise known as the SCL90, because it was 98.
So we were able to measure whether this patient's symptoms went up or down throughout the 6 months, whether the symptoms correlated with the higher ORF throughout that time. We also tested whether this patient, with whether the treatment was prototypically psychodynamic or CBT or depersonal, and whether, depending on the PQS score, we were able to correlate that score also with the symptoms, also with the RF throughout the time of 6 months.
What's the PQS?
The PQS is a 100, it's a 100 item measure that indicates,
process.
Yes, that indicates the process of the session, whether you have 100 cards and you put them into different piles. So if card one gets put into 505 listed, and that's prototypically a psychodynamic prototype, but through that type of treatment card, one usually goes in 505. That would be a prototypically psychodynamic treatment.
Actually, be neither characteristic nor uncharacteristic of psychodynamic treatment.
Oh.
The ones in pile 79
would
be prototypic. Okay. There are 9 piles that you can put each of these 100 items in, ranging from most uncharacteristic of the session to most characteristic of the session. These transcripts that we're going to be coding, 127 of them, have already been coded for the PQS, the psychotherapy process Q set. So we're not going to be dealing with that at all.
Were those coded from the transcript?
What's
was
that?
Was the Q-sort done from the transcripts?
Yeah. So the transcripts were given to another coding team a number of years ago, and that coding team did the Q-sort for all 127 sessions. So we already have those data in the bank. So I'd rather they not get caught up in all of that, but the RF is important. Now let me ask you 2 questions about the RF. How many anchor points are on that scale?
9. The RF.
9?
0 to 9.
Is there minus 1?
Oh, yeah. Dr. Steele said that it's so rare.
It is rare.
Yeah, so -1 to 9.
So it's 11 anchor points. Okay. And tell me what the difference is between reflective functioning and empathy. Because they're very, very similar. Everybody has a general idea what empathy is, but I think you're all kind of struggling what mentalization is and reflective. Reflective functioning is just the operationalization of mentalization. It's how we measure mentalization. So we're really talking about mentalization, but how is that different from empathy? We can kind of understand it's similar. How is it different?
I think you can have empathy for somebody, but not understand your own mental beliefs or feelings and thoughts. So empathy is more, I guess, how I think about it, more geared to the other person. Mentalization is about both your own and the other.
Yeah, that's part of it. I think even more. More drawing a distinction between the two also involves the idea that empathy is more about just strictly feelings. I know what you're feeling, but mentalization involves any kind of mental state. So feelings, thoughts, beliefs, intentions, wishes, all of that's included in mental states. And so also it's usually almost always connected to behavior. So if you're behaving in a certain way, I attribute to you certain underlying mental states, certain intentionality regarding that. So if I slap this chair like that, many of you will think, okay, so Dr. Goodman is angry or he's upset. So you're attributing a mental state to my behavior. So it's a form of interpretation, really. So that's very different from empathy, where it's just I know what you're feeling, or I can feel what you're feeling, or I can go and get into your shoes and kind of feel what you're feeling. That's empathy. But mentalization, actually attributing a mental state or an intentionality to a person based on the behavior that they're engaging in. You understand the difference between the two? It's very subtle. It's a subtle difference, but there is a difference between the two. Empathy is sort of like mentalization, but there are important differences that you should be aware of.
And theory of mind is similar.
Theory of mind is also included in that. So think of individuals who have a deficit in theory of mind. Autism spectrum children have a lot of difficulty understanding the underlying mental states behind people's behaviors. So people's intentions are opaque to them. They can't really see and read a person's mind. Mentalization, according to Fonagy, is a form of mind reading. I can read your mind. I understand why you're behaving the way you behave. Mind reading is different from empathy. So there are some distinctions there that you should be aware of. So think of it as mind reading, I guess would be a shorthand way of thinking about it.
Mentalization is also measured by a computerized version of reflective functioning.
So why the hell are we here doing it manually?
I don't know. Because it's so new, and it hasn't quite been validated yet because it's so new.
There's only one study.
There's only one study for TUC.
2012?
Yeah. So it's really new. So we're hoping that our score, and I have the CRF on my computer, and it's basically, you don't do what we're going to do, coding it manually, but you still have to change the transcripts to the specifics of like, the word I am. On the computer, it's I apostrophe M, but you have to space those out. Because it should count as two words. So it still takes time. It doesn't take as long as doing it manually, but it still takes time to make these edits. You'll see when you get the transcripts, and the transcripts start with T, that stands for therapist, apostrophe, and this number. That has to be deleted because we don't want that counting as a word. So it takes time, but we're hoping that the CRF and RF codes are the same, because that would really help CRF. With CRF, it would be great if it works, because then manual coders for RF, it takes a long time, and a computer can do it.
In your dissertation, are you trying to validate CRF that way?
Hoping that it does.
That's one of the goals of Deb's dissertation. Mm-hmm. Why don't you get into a little bit exactly how you're going to apply this coding system, which was born and raised in attachment literature, to psychotherapy transcripts?
So we looked at how other studies have done this. There were two other studies. So one study did this. And the way it's done, because it's really better to make the whole transcript into chunks of 150 word blocks. So what we're going to do as a team is break up the transcripts into 150 word blocks, and then with each 150 word block, that's what you code. And so at the end of that transcript, we see, you know, what we coded for each word block. We'll see how it compares.
So, for example, let's say a transcript. Well, you did one actually.
Yeah.
How many word blocks? I you sent that information to me. How many word blocks?
I think it was 27
blocks of 150 words.
Right, but it only takes an hour.
Per transcript.
Right.
So we're going to figure out.
There are 43.
3 hours.
43 out of
150 word blocks. Okay, in that particular transcript. And you picked a random transcript.
Yeah.
Okay. So, you said 43? So, you basically go through, you count, literally count the number of words, and then put a slash. Count the next number of 150 words, put another slash, and there were 43 of those. And it took Deb an hour to do that for a transcript. Just make the demarcations.
Because just like you're doing, just like I do it for CRF, breaking up those apostrophe words, you have to do that with this too. Because every word should count.
So we're doing that part, because you just did that for the one for the poster?
No, you guys are going to be doing that.
But
But so for each transcript, it took an hour to code or to.
Well, you did just for one.
Just
so we're assuming that.
Right.
But, and you're a little bit more experienced. By the time you get up to speed, it should take an hour to break up the transcript into blocks, word blocks, and an hour to code.
These transcripts aren't on a computer in like Word form or anything?
See, I was thinking that, but I don't think we can play around with it. I don't think it would account for those different words.
But can it do a certain final replace all?
Yeah.
Or would you not?
This is
awesome.
That would probably take a lot of time. You also shouldn't include like the T for therapist, the P for patient, but yeah, that might reduce some time.
I mean, you can play around with it, but
yeah.
I don't, would it save you some time? I don't know.
I mean, I feel
like sometimes there are numbers in here.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, like you could sort of highlight an area and find the word count. So
That would work. You'd have to delete all the T's and P's for therapist and patient. What other?
The numbers. There are certain numbers.
Do they count as words in Word?
I don't know. Yeah.
So you'd have to massage the data to do it that way. You did it just strictly actual counting of words, right?
Did you go through the second
passage
for accuracy, or did you just
went
through it once?
I just went through it once. There are some passages where I went through it two times if I thought I was distracted or lost count or something. It helped me when I got to 100 to put like a little 100 just in case you don't have to go back completely. I took some breaks, like just because I got it. But it's really, I mean, it's just counting. It's not
rocket science.
It's not rocket science.
But you know, I think that. I mean, that's a strategy we can think of. I don't want to like start assessing inter-rater reliability on where we put the line. You know, it's, the line is a little bit less important than the score, right? If you're off one or two words where you put the line, I don't think it's going to, you know, decrease your reliability in the scoring that much. I mean, we want to make it as accurate as possible, but I'm not going to be assessing inter-rater reliability of where you put the slash. It's a little bit too tedious. But I think, you know, my idea, you know, when we start would be like giving each person one interview or one transcript to code. And then both pairs of the team, so you'd be broken up into pairs of two. So both pairs of the team will do this, the breaking up into 150 words, and then you know you guys can compare. And I have some practice sessions that we're going to be using for training purposes, which I need to get you. Maybe we can do that after this meeting. And then once we get the hang of it, I think, then what we'll do is I'll increase so that each person is rating two interviews per week. But maybe one team member can do the word blocking for one of the transcripts and the other team member can do the word blocking for the other transcript, but you're both coding both transcripts. Is that clear or not clear? Let me make something clear. Each team of two coders is coding every transcript between them. So for example, let's say Aaron and Melissa were paired up. I'm just picking them because they're paired up on the PL. So let's say they're paired up, and so I give you two interviews to code. Interviews 1A and 1B. You're coding 1A and 1B, and you're coding 1A and 1B. So it's not like you're coding 1A and you're coding 1B. You're both coding 1A and 1B. All right? But for this word blocking situation that we're talking about, maybe you'll word block 1A and you'll word block 1B, And then you'll share your word blocking slashes with Melissa. And Melissa, you'll share your word blocking slashes with Aaron. Does that,
yeah.
People understand that? That's critical. I mean, that saves some time right there. So for the word blocking, you're only going to be doing one word blocking transcript per week, even though you might be coding two. You'll be coding two.
Would that be, we do it in the same week, word blocking as you code?
It depends on how you want it.
We're doing all the word blocking first. Then
it's just easier. And for me, it was. If it works differently, then you'll know. But for me, it worked that once I word blocked it, I could just focus on it.
I think it's less distracting. If you get the tedious task out of the way, then you can just get into coding mode. Because if you're counting and then stopping and coding and then. I think it's more distracting. But, you know, I don't want to squash anybody's creativity in how to go about the task. You know, the bottom line is you got to be reliable with your partner. That's all I really care about, and that's all that Deb really cares about. If you're reliable with your partner, I'm good. How you get to that goal, whether you want to take this roundabout route, go over the hill, go under the bushes, whatever you want to do to get there, you know, it's really up to you. We can make recommendations, but ultimately it's how reliable are you? You know, and our goal is 0.8. So I'm going to be calculating reliability and then eventually turning that over to Deb, calculating reliability on each 150 word block. So let's say word block 1 in transcript 1A. Melissa scores a 6, which is a fairly high score in RF parlance. And Aaron scores at a 5. It's pretty close. Not too bad. You go to the next word block. Melissa scores at a 2. Aaron scores at a 6. Well, that's more of a problem. That's a discrepancy. But if you have 43 of these comparisons, that's a nice sample size. I can calculate your reliability for that particular transcript pretty easily. You'll be sending me your reliability for the word blocks. Okay, so from word block 1 to word block 43 or whatever it is, you'll be sending me those scores like 5, 2, 7, 1, negative 1, 2, 7, 4, all the way down to 43. Both of you send those to me the night before, and then I run a correlation and I see where you're at as far as your reliability. And then we use the meetings then to figure out how you're doing with discrepancies, what's going on with the major discrepancies between, you know, the one partner's score and the other partner's score. And Melissa, you know how I work because you've basically done this kind of work before. So am I missing anything or?
No, I mean, in meetings are just times to kind of figure out differences of opinions and kind of set some like grounds, sort of maybe like we could find some sort of benchmark. If you see something like this repeating, this is a 3. Have some similar to do with the symbolic play, like sort of go to like benchmarks for the coding.
Right, and make up some of our own rules because we're really applying a coding system that wasn't developed for coding psychotherapy transcripts, so we're going to have to make up some of our own rules, which we did on Giacomo and Chris's teams. You know, Melissa is kind of a ringer here. She has already coded RF in data that are not AAI data. You coded 3 different kinds of data. You want to talk about that a little bit? Or I don't want to put you on the spot. But
no, that's fine. I think it was the same question that they asked participants was describe yourself, describe your mother, describe your father, and take 5 minutes, right? Or
mm-hmm. It's 5 minutes.
5 minutes. And so, I mean, some people would write like a sentence, some people would write like a whole couple paragraphs of it, but basically we're applying the RF scale to that to see their ability to minimize themselves.
So we looked at 3 different scales. Two of the scales came from a researcher, Sidney Blatt, at Yale University, and he developed something called the Object Representation Inventory, the ORI, and we adapted two of his rating scales from that coding system. One was called conceptual...
Reasoning?
No, it was conceptual...
Was it CR, though?
Yeah, but it's not reasoning. Conceptual... forget what it is, conceptual something, but it measures the complexity and the quality of the person's object representation. So whether it's mother, father, or self, we're measuring the complexity of that response, and there was a rating scale related to that, and we applied that to those data, and then there was another scale related to the ORI measuring boundary relatedness and boundary differentiation. Conceptual relatedness, wasn't that it?
Yeah.
I think it was conceptual relatedness.
Mm-hmm.
And then boundary relatedness and boundary differentiation was the second one, and then the third one was RF. So we coded the same data for three different coding systems. It was quite a mammoth undertaking, and Chris and Giacomo had collected their data online. So those data were different, but we still adapted the RF for a different set of data than what it was originally intended for, which was to code adult attachment interviews. But, I mean, Chris didn't get significant findings, but Giacomo did, and I'm still trying to prod him to write up his dissertation into an article because it's incredibly publishable, and I think a lot of people would be interested in his findings. So, I mean, he could get it published in a top-tier journal easily. But anyway, I think Deb's dissertation has a lot of potential, too, to get published in a very prestigious journal. And so that's what we're hoping for, to get this information out there. But Melissa has some of this expertise already, and so looking to her to help us out as we go along in applying the RF to psychotherapy transcripts, which I haven't done before. It's only been done twice. So that's just a little bit more background, but maybe you can talk a little bit more then about the actual coding of RF as it applies to when you did it for the one transcript you did it with.
So, I have the RF manual. We could send that out.
Well, I have to, yeah.
But basically, the RF manual, it's really complicated at first, and then you see the same kind of things coming up. So, for instance, with this transcript, I don't just have the RF codes, I have there's one major theme that codes, for example, 6.4. I think 6.4 stands for let's say 6.5. It's like a self-serving, distorting the picture, the situation, and not really having a good grasp. The patient didn't seem to have a good grasp of what was going on. So it says in the manual, let's say it's 6.5. It says in the manual, a lot of 6.5s or meridians mostly gets a 2 or 3 rating. Dr. Still said it was okay to write 2.5, stuff like that. So if you're unsure, you can also do that, 2.5, you know, in between.
No 2.25 and 2.7. Or 2.33 or 2.66. We're not going to do that.
So you'll see when you read the manual. I would read it a few times. It's interesting. And then once you read the transcripts and you have the manual right next to you, we'll go through the first transcript together, so we'll get a good sense of what a 2 is, what a 3 is, and more specifically what these numbers in our manual stand for, what it would look like.
So it's a pretty, you'll see in the manual it has a lot of history about how it came about, but actual, like the actual numbers for each code. It's like a very small paragraph to give you a quick example. Sometimes he gives you, in quotation marks, what a 6.4 would look like, or what a 6.5 would look like, to give you some kind of a little
Well, maybe you could clarify. You just said 6.4. Now, they might be thinking, well, you just said that we're going to use half points, but not 6.4.
Oh.
They might be, they're not aware that you're talking about sections of the coding manual.
Okay, so
the codes for RF are from -1 to 9. But you'll see within the manual, there are codes to help you figure out what the RF code is. So in order to figure out what the RF code is, you'll see certain themes throughout the transcript. So let's say a theme or a common thing among the patient, a common saying among the patient, seem to be inappropriate or sort of bizarre sounding, like your sentences weren't making sense. Let's say that is 6.4. It would be 6.4, bizarre, comma, inappropriate. This is just within the manual. This isn't an RF code. But if you look in the manual and you see 6.4, bizarre, inappropriate, you would see a lot of, it says a lot of 6.4s, mostly on either 2s or 3s RF. Does that make sense? So I think it goes, I think to get an RF coding of, let's say, a 5, you'll see that the codes in the manual, a lot of them are 4 point something. It goes 4.1, I think, to 4.6 or something. But that's just to help you figure out what the RF code is. But it is helpful to write down 6.4, and then 6.4, and then 6.4, and then you see, oh, maybe this is a 2 or 3.
So maybe for the purpose of next week, I'll send out a practice transcript. Maybe you can divide it up and code it. And I will have sent out also, along with this transcript, the coding system, the manual. And then they can follow along next week as you break down. Can you be here next week?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. As you break down the code, how you actually went about the coding. And so your assignment for next week is basically to read the manual. It's kind of a long manual. It won't take you 6 hours to read, but it's complex. I'm not going to lie to you. It's a complex coding system. It's going to take some time to really sink our teeth into it and get the hang of it. Would you agree? It's pretty complex.
Definitely,
it's not something you can do while you're doing it. You have to be really focused on it. The word counting, you can listen to music. That's needed. So, should I pick a random transcript again?
No, we're going to. We're going to go dip into a practice, these practice transcripts I have. Because I don't want them to be exposed to any of the real transcripts that we're recording.
Okay.
Now, there are 4 general categories of RF. Do you want to go into that at all? Or I don't know if you're prepared to talk about that. You know what I'm talking about? Well, one is, you know, the developmental aspects to mentalization. So mentalization depends upon the observer's awareness of the other person's age. So, for example, if I have a little child here, I'm not going to assume that her crying has to do with the fact that she hates all of you. right? She's crying because she's hungry or she's wet or whatever. But if an adult, if one of you started crying, I would definitely take that personally. It would have a very different meaning. Well, why? Because you're at an age where you're just not going to cry because you're hungry or wet. There's going to be something very wrong, emotionally wrong, if you start crying in a context like this one. And that would make me very concerned. Whereas if a baby were crying, I wouldn't be so concerned. I would think, oh, he or she is hungry or wet or something like that. That's RF based on the developmental understanding of the other person. But there are three other categories. You want to...
I have a question. So when we talk about development, are we talking about attachment also?
Well, no. I'm talking about the ways in which you score RF. You have to take into account, the observer takes into account their developmental needs, and then there are three other categories that Fonagy talks about. I don't mean to put you on the spot.
No, totally. Okay. I mean, I guess the Fonagy spoke about this, the interpersonal relatedness. Is that what you're talking about?
It's later on in the manual.
I mean,
you don't? Okay, so let me put it up here. Just a minute. So what I'm going to do is, okay, here are the four categories. The first is the awareness of the nature of mental states. How do mental states work? What are they all about? So, for example, mental states are ultimately opaque, right? So we're all engaged in the mind reading in mind reading right now, but we're also aware that we might be wrong, that we don't really know what somebody's thinking. Somebody can be smiling all the time, and they might be crying on the inside, right? Because we don't know ultimately what another person is feeling. So there's an opaqueness of... That's just an example of the awareness of the nature of mental states. What are the characteristics or properties of a mental state? So that's one category of mentalization that Fonagy has defined. The second one is teasing out mental states' underlying behavior. Right, so if we observe a particular behavior, how do we characterize our ability to attribute a mental state to that behavior? Right, so teasing out which mental state is responsible for which behavior that we're observing. So that's the second category. The third category is recognizing the developmental aspects of mental states. I just went over that. And the fourth category is... mental states in relation to the interviewer. So in this case, it would be mental states in relation to the therapist. So how is the patient mentalizing the therapist at that given moment? Right, so that's going to be a very important category for us to explore as we go through the coding of these sessions. Now, you know, a patient can be talking about their mom, their father, boyfriend, girlfriend, whatever. But it also, they're also relating to the therapist at the same time. So it's the relationship with the therapist specifically that's captured by this fourth category. It's like a subscale of mental, these four subscales of mentalization. Does that ring a bell?
Yeah. With the AI, is the example of the mental states we most did the interviewer. It's for the AI. This was like some patient might be crying, and she might say to the interviewer, "Oh, you must think this is too much, but I didn't explain to you this." You know, kind of trying to get where the interviewer, how the interviewer might be feeling about the story that she's telling. With the therapist, though, I would imagine that having this one transcript, it is different because these therapists have been with the patient for 6 months. So there might be a lot more of this than with the interview, whereas it takes about an hour, months.
That's true. But, you know, let's say a patient might reveal material that the therapist hasn't heard before. Like, you know, "I didn't tell you this before, and I know this might sound upsetting to you, but, you know, I was sexually abused as a child." Wow. Okay. So the patient had the wherewithal to understand that what she was about to say to the therapist was going to, might have a negative impact on the therapist, and she was preparing the therapist for the disclosure that she was sexually abused as a child. So it takes some mentalization to be able to do that. And I don't know exactly what the score would be. I'd have to have the rating scale in front of me, but that's just an example of this fourth category or subscale of mentalization that Fonagy has defined, which he, what he calls, yeah, mental states in relation to the interviewer. So that would be here.
And like I said before, the fours of this manual usually coincide with the higher part. Higher than two.
So
the four categories are 4.1, awareness of the nature of mental states. That starts on page 19. And then these different subsections here, from 4.11 to 4.15, they're just different ways, different examples of the awareness of the nature of mental states. I talked about the opaqueness of mental states, but here are some others here. Mental states is susceptible to disguise, the recognition of the limitations on insight, mental states tied to expressions of appropriate normative judgments, awareness of the defensive nature of certain mental states.
And he gives you examples of each one.
Yeah. So if I go around and saying, "Oh, I just love LIU. Isn't LIU wonderful?" You know, if I go a little bit too far in that, you might start to wonder, geez, I wonder whether he's defending against underlying feelings of hostility toward LIU, right? So, you know, I mean, what psychoanalytically, for those of you in grad school here, what would the name of that defense mechanism be?
Reaction
formation. Exactly. Right. So psychoanalytically, we have a name for that, but it's the awareness of the defensive nature of certain mental states. We're defending against one mental state with another mental state. It's a very, very similar to reaction formation. So that's the awareness of the nature of mental states. That's how mental states work. Then we've got the explicit effort to tease out mental states' underlying behavior. That's 4.2. That starts on page 21. And then there are different examples of that, the explicit effort to tease out mental states. Accurate attributions of mental states to others, et cetera, et cetera. We don't have time to go into it now, but I do, maybe you could really get into this for next week, and we can really start teaching next week. And then The third subscale is recognizing the developmental aspects of mental states. I started out with that idea. Taking an intergenerational perspective, making links across generations, taking developmental perspective, revising thoughts and feelings about childhood in light of understanding gains since childhood. So, you know, somebody could say, you know, my father was really mean to me as a child. I never understood that, and I thought he was really being a jerk. But now, as I'm an adult, I look back and I see that he was under a lot of pressure at his job, and he had had a bad relationship with his brother, and that really, you know, made him very angry and sullen, and he took it out on me. So I'm taking a childhood experience, which might have been very painful, and then as an adult, I'm able to look back and say, oh, that's what might have been going on with him. That's a form of mentalization, and that will be covered under 4.33. So it's all recognizing the developmental aspects of mental states. And then the last one, which starts on page 25, is mental states in relation to the interviewer, which we just talked about, acknowledging the separateness of minds, like my mind is different from your mind, being therapist. Not assuming knowledge, so I don't assume that you know what I know. And emotional attunement, this is going to be painful, but I was sexually abused as a child. You know, preparing the interviewer because you know that the interviewer is going to have some kind of reaction to that. That's emotional attunement. So those are the four categories. If you can kind of get those under your belt, the coding should go easier for you. So then when we take these 150-word blocks, what we're going to be doing is we're trying to figure out, okay, what kind of mental, if there is mentalization going on, there might be a whole 150-word chunk where there's no mentalization. And then you just put NA, right? No mentalization. We did that for a number of the RF that we scored in the ORI, right?
Yeah, I think it wasn't like either too short or
not codable, right? NC. And we might have that. There might be 150-word blocks where we're not. There's nothing really to assess. It's not like it's anti-reflective. It's not reflective. It's just nothing going on. But when there is something going on, you should be able to identify which of these four categories is being expressed. So those are four very important facets of mentalization you really need to understand by for next week. Then, just orienting to the manual, I guess. So then there's some general considerations, and then just talking about some other aspects to coding, reflective functioning, and then some illustrations of negative, that's negative one, or limited, that would be like a zero reflective functioning, what would that look like? And these are borderline, I'll just tell you right now, these are borderline patients, so unlike the coding that you did, which was a normal sample, right. It was gay and lesbian respondents and then therapists for Giacomo's dissertation. I mean, basically, normative samples. This is not a normative sample, so we're going to get more bizarre, inappropriate, negative ones and zeros. I'm guessing we will. So it would be important, we're going to be looking at that and possible implications of these subtypes of impoverished reflective functioning and then rejection of RF. Unintegrated, bizarre, inappropriate RF, disavowal of RF, distorting or self-serving RF, naive or simplistic RF, and then overly analytical or what he calls hyperactive RF. These are all important aspects to RF. This is more like the process of RF as opposed to the different categories or facets of RF. This is the process of it, how it feels when we're looking at it. So then, okay, reading passages. So actual passages from the from AAIs that Fonagy has collected. The rules for identifying passages. This isn't appropriate for us. We're not dealing with demand versus permit questions because there are no questions. It's a psychotherapy process. Guidelines for rating identified passages, rules for aggregating reflective functioning ratings into a single score. That's not so important. And then the overall interview rating. And then Appendix 1 obviously is going to be important because that's the outline of scoring procedures, how you're actually going to do it. And the rating scale also is in the appendix, right? Questions? No? It's clear?
One more question from
Yeah, and then next week we can go through each of these, you know, what each one means,
Yeah, we'll talk about each one of those examples, Melissa. Yeah, definitely. Melissa can't make it next week, so I'm podcasting all of our future, including today's coding team meetings, just so we have a record of what we're doing and what we're deciding, because we're going to be making decisions as we go along. We're going to be somewhat making our own rules because we're adapting. As I keep saying, we're adapting a coding system that wasn't originally designed or intended to measure RF in psychotherapy sessions. There is no such measure, so we're adapting something from another source for our purposes. And whenever you do that, you're going to have to, you know, make some adaptations or modifications. And we certainly did that when we were coding the ORI responses in Chris and Giacomo's dissertations. So.
And in the workshop, I want to help your students that, you know, sometimes just this overall, once you understand the manual and we've gone through some of these transcripts, with these transcripts, it's, sometimes you just get a sense of an overall aura. It might not be, you can go through it pretty extensively, but there's not an exact calculation. So.
Yeah, it's going to be your best guess of where this 150-word chunk falls on the scale of negative 1 to 9. I mean, each chunk is going to get a score. And you're going to enter those scores into an Excel file from 1 to 43, or how many of your word chunks are in your particular transcript. And next to those, it's going to be your scores, and you're going to email them to me, and I'm going to calculate how close you come to your partner.
We have a few words left. Those aren't included, right?
I don't know. What did Joseph recommend?
He didn't even say anything.
Oh, he didn't?
No, I did it at that point again, but I looked because I had those two, I mean, there were two words left.
Oh, well. So, well, let's say you had 75 words left.
Yeah.
What would you do? I don't know.
Yeah, I'll look at it again.
Yeah, just make sure. I mean, we might want to just go with the rule we're going to only code full 150-word chunks. And if there's 149 words at the end, we don't code it. I mean, we might make that rule up. Make it up as we go. But check the Larry Joseph's article and just see if he has any rules. I could email him also and find out if he has a rule for that. But you check first and then email me and then... If he doesn't specify in his article, I'll email him myself and find out. All right. The only other researcher to break up the transcript into 150-word chunks is Larry Josephs. He's a professor at Adelphi, and I have been friends with him, so he's going to be helpful to us, I think, as we go along and we encounter certain obstacles or questions. You know, if we can't make up our minds about how to treat a particular issue or conflict, we can always ask him how he might have done it in his lab. So,
okay. Also, if you have any questions when you're reading the manual, you can email me and I can answer to the best of my ability, or we can bring that to the research meeting next week.
In my experience of Deb is that she, like me, is very responsive to email, and you know, Deb is very committed to this project. I mean, it's very clear from conversations we had in your first year. You know, you were very intent on doing something very interesting, and I think you've latched on to something that's really very powerful. And so she's motivated to get this done and done right. And so she's going to be very responsive to you guys, as I will be also, with any kinds of questions or concerns as we go along. And, you know, when I take my sabbatical in the spring, I won't be here physically, but I'll be here in spirit. And I'll still have email contact. And I might even be able to join via Skype. I don't know. That I don't know yet, but definitely email contact. And Deb will be a very able group leader. So, anything else? We can break early, and then next week we'll really start in earnest to learn this coding system. How's that sound? Yep, the manual and a practice session. Don't code the session. I mean, you guys wouldn't know how to do it, but you can certainly break up the session into 150-word chunks, and we'll see how reliable everybody is in doing that. Is that, you think that makes sense? Or maybe you should just do the word chunking. They're going to have their hands full with just reading the manual. The manual, I really want you guys to really just get into that manual. Take a long time to get into it. It's kind of long, and it might take going through it several times. So I'd rather they not. Would it be okay if you word chunked the first one and just sent it out to them and tell them where the slashes are?
Sure. Can I do the word chunks
before
we come?
Do you,
I don't know about
what
we're
yeah, we
can
do that.
Though, right? Yes. Why do we need to know the word chunks?
Yeah, that's true.
Photocopy everything.
Yeah.
I could photocopy.
Or at the beginning of next week's meeting, you can just tell everybody, you'll have it in front of you, because
right.
I'll send it to you, print it out, and you'll tell everybody where the slashes belong. How's that?
I have a question on that.
Yeah.
I mean, just for the future when we're all coding these, wouldn't it be easier if it was just photocopied so you don't have to waste the time being like, okay, see down in this paragraph in between these two words?
Well, who's going to be doing it, though? Not Deb.
No, I was just thinking right before the meeting.
Well, and when we do it really after we're done training, it's just a pair doing it.
So right, so you'll be like doing the slashes for 1A, and Aaron would be doing the slashes for 1B.
We could just copy this. We're not coding in that week. So we could, at the end of, once, say we're done with our 30 sessions or whatever it is, we finish slashing them, and we then just make a copy of everything. So...
Yeah. Because only one person is doing the word body and two people are doing the code.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So if you make a copy of the word body, that means you're
Yeah, however you communicate where the slashes go for your partner is up to you. If you want to photocopy, if you want to call on the phone and just give it over the phone, however you want to do that, it's fine. As I said before, you know, the what I'm concerned about is the end result. How you get there, how you parachute onto the island is up to you. When you parachute on, you take a sailboat, or you swim, or however you get to that island is up to you, but we all have to get on that island. How do you like that metaphor? Prepare for themselves.
Maybe you should send this podcast to Jocelyn and guilt him into writing that article.
I would love to guilt him. Would you like to guilt him?
Email him
All right, so any other questions? So see you guys next week, and I'll get you this coding manual tonight with a practice session. Well, I want to do that now, actually. So Tina and you actually should all get copies of the practice ones that I have. All you have are the real sessions. And you have the real sessions, right? No? And you don't have them. So you haven't given them to Tina yet. She has, Tina and Jessica have a mailbox downstairs. All right. So, do you have that flash drive or a different flash drive for today? So I'd like to give you this practice. Okay. Will that work? So I'll create a file on here. Oh, this is a Mac?
I don't know. They didn't specify it last time.
Have you used it on a Mac before?
Yes.
Yeah, I think it's probably not going to work. No.
Is it de-identified?
Yes.
Could you email it to me?
The problem is that it's like, it's a lot of files, and so it'd be a lot of work. What I could, are you on Dropbox?
I had some.
Oh, look, it's Demaria Timeline. So it does work.
It does work.
Goodman Paper 1. That's from Child Psychopathology. Let's see. Effective genetic testing on female adolescents for cancer. Wow. Good times, good times. The psychological impact on genetically testing for breast and ovarian cancer. All right. All right, so this will work. I just want to create a new folder.
There.
Yeah, just pick a random one, maybe the first one.
Okay.
Something like that. So I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. I have 10 samples. So it's not a, you know, it's not a lot.
Do you have a Mac or do you have my flash drive only?
But it works for me. Are you talking about
the other one, the one with all the
right? So you have to get an iron key,
yeah.
put them on an iron key, and then transfer to them.
I'll see if Kathy has an extra.
Yeah, try that. She's probably gone for today.
I don't know if they have it.
Yeah, check, and or just you buy another flash drive.
Yeah.
So you're responsible then for giving them the 127 real sessions plus the 10 sample sessions, which you have on that flash drive now.
Flash drive?
Yeah.
So you have the mailbox.